Hello, and welcome to this evening Moms Fighting Autism webinar. I'm Chantal Cecile Kira, moderator for this evening. I'm also the author of Autism Life Skills, Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and Autism Spectrum Disorders. And I'm really thrilled to see all the questions coming in. I can see questions from all over the United States, from Canada, from Mexico City, Saudi Arabia, India, and I'm really happy that we're able to provide a resource like this to help people. And I'm hoping that we'll get to all your questions. My guest this evening is Dr. Joshua Fader, and I'm very honored that he's agreed to be here with us. He is one of the specialists of DIR Floor Time. Dr. Fader specializes in neurobehavioral medicine and applies DIR floor time with families and in schools. He does research, teaches, consults, and hosts support groups for professionals and families. Dr. Fader sits on the bridge, which is Bond, Regulate, Interact, Develop, Guide, and Engage Collaborative, a community-wide effort for early identification and intervention in San Diego County. Yes, I live in San Diego, so I'm happy to say that we are very lucky in our community to have Dr. Fader here. He serves as Medical Education Director for the Rady Children's Hospital Autism Research Workgroup and has served on the Autism Committee and on the Medications and Autism Panel of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Fader reviews grants for the Organization for Autism Research and the National Foundation for Autism Research and is a commentator on Valerie's List, a web-based information service for autism and related disorders. He's also recently written an article which is appearing this month in the Autism File magazine. Welcome, Dr. Fader.
Well, it's great to be here, Chantal.
I really appreciate you taking the time to be on this webinar. And I know that... go ahead.
Go ahead.
I think that we would like you, if possible, to spend some time talking about what is DIR floor time. And so perhaps for 15 or 20 minutes, if you could talk more about that, and then we'll go to questions that people have emailed in.
That sounds
great.
It sounds perfect. If people are logged in and have a couple tabs on their browsers, the talk that I'm giving is posted at circlestretch.blogspot.com, which is our local San Diego blog for information about DIR floor time. So if you log on there, you can actually follow the slides as we go. I'll be skipping over some of them because I don't want to take more than about 15 or 20 minutes. But certainly through the questions, we'll be able to get back to a number of the issues. As Chantal said, I'm a child and family psychiatrist. I see probably half my practice is people with developmental and learning disorders, the other half people with all kinds of things, usually people who've seen a bunch of doctors and we're trying to figure out what's going on, so they come and see me and I puzzle through with them. And I am an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSD School of Medicine, and through that is where I work on the Ethics Committee for the Psychiatric Society, do some of the teaching in ethics, and then also work at Rady Children's Hospital as a volunteer for the Autism Research Workgroup and the Bridge Collaborative, some of these other functions. But my role here is as faculty on the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders, which is a bunch of big words for saying that Dr. Stanley Greenspan, Dr. Sarita Weider, basically created a foundation a number of years ago to try to work on early intervention and do training, not just across the country but around the world, in helping people relate better and learn better. And so I'll be talking quite a bit about DIR floor time. just because I always do disclosures, and it's probably important that people do that these days, I get, basically my funding is from private families who ask for care, and I have minimal funding from ICDL for reviewing clinical write-ups of clinicians who wish to be certified, and they also fund conferences where I teach. And I also do get some minimal funding from NIMH through Duke University for administrative time for some pharmacogenetic research, which I don't plan to talk about tonight. ICDL is, as I said, is located really out of Washington, D.C. They've got a wonderful website, icdl.com, which has all kinds of open access information you can download, 800 pages of information on floor time, and probably a couple hundred hours of free podcasts or transcripts of Dr. Greenspan talking about this. So you can learn to listen to him on your way to work and learn quite a bit. I am going to go pretty quickly. Again, if you're in front of the slides, I'm going to skim over the slides marked with an orange spot, so you're not dwelling on those while I'm moving on. The slides are posted on Circle Stretch. Our motto at Circle Stretch is to help a child be calm enough to interact, truly connected to others, and in a continuous, expanding, balanced, back-and-forth flow of interaction. So we always say go for that gleam in the eye, and hopefully you'll know what I mean by the time we're done tonight. If you're taking notes, there's really only one word you have to write down. It's the word engagement, or one phrase, engagement goes beyond compliance. And again, we'll try to flesh out what that means. So what is DIR? Well, it stands for Developmental Individual Differences Relationship-Based Intervention, not to be confused, by the way, with RDI, Relationship Developmental Intervention, and I'll speak a little bit more to that later on. There's always confusion about all these, letters and different people calling things the same thing. In San Diego, we have CASE, CARES, ACEs, all these people using similar letters for their organizations, and the same confusion occurs with DIR and RDI. And while there are some similarities, there's some big, important philosophical differences. DIR came from the fields of infant mental health, from the developmental literature studying parent-child relationships, and really is the brainchild of Stanley Greenspan and later on Dr. Serena Weider, again out of Washington, D.C. There is a lot of empirical support for DIR. If you're going to IEPs in the United States where people are trying to figure out how we're going to intervene to help kids, and there are these rules in the U.S. that speak to having methods that are empirically validated, people wonder, is DIR validated? And in fact, the technique itself does have brain imaging studies done by John Steiben at York University that show when you do this stuff with kids versus controls, if you will, in a population of kids with autism spectrum disorders, high-functioning autism, you actually get improvement clinically, but you also get brain changes that somewhat normalize, not fully, but somewhat normalize what they look like on their scans. So it's pretty compelling stuff. Rick Solomon has a streamlined version of DIR called the Play Project, where he's trying to make it more possible to implement in communities around the country in the U.S., and has also done a prospective study that shows improvement. And there are hundreds of treatment reports, including a review of 200 cases and follow-up on that group done by Greenspan and Weider at one time. Basically the entire developmental literature, the genetics and environment literature, and even mathematical analysis of neurologic processes, including learning and vigilance, supports this kind of approach. I'm not going to spend too much more time on that. If I were just give a definition of DIR, I would give you a whole bunch of fancy words, but what I would really boil it down to is that we use emotional connection to foster the child's social, emotional, cognitive, and communication development. And we work within the child's profile of individual strengths and challenges while also working to improve that profile so that they can tolerate more and work better within their environment. And it's really important that emotional connection, meaning like affect is the word that we use, is really the glue that holds everything together, holds the intervention, holds the relationship together, and makes the learning and the development possible. So we work with families and others to try to make this happen, this affective emotional connection happen all the time, 24/7. So how does DIR help? Well, we can take what's apparently a hardwired disorder and change it. And so we're always asking, what's the best way to change things? And there's a long behavioral tradition, and it's very clear that surface behaviors can be changed. Lots of things can be learned, like asking for things, manding, or teaching a person to do and say what we want the person to do or say. And by contrast, DIR helps the child become more connected with the world and to learn for herself and adapt to her world. So it's a very different philosophy, complementary, but I would argue that DIR kind of expands beyond behavioral kinds of approaches. So, it's the difference, some of the differences are between prompting somebody to do something in sort of a top-down fashion versus wooing them into a relationship where you build and learn together about the world. Not that you're not adding your own ideas so the child will learn, but it's not like you're just telling them what to learn or asking the questions that you already know the answer to. And it's also the difference, as I alluded to earlier, between compliance versus engagement. Compliance is, do what I want you to do. Engagement is, be with me, let's look at the world together. And actually, compliance ends up coming from engagement. If you look at kids who have, if they're just a typical kid in school and they're doing all their work and they're sitting at their desk, a lot of times, we don't think about it, but the kid is really complying because they're part of the social milieu. They've bought into the idea of being in class and studying. But for children who have developmental and learning challenges and are frustrated and we're spending a lot more time telling them to sit and to pay attention and to do these things, they might not really be connected with the idea of the whole classroom and what it means to be there and feel connected with the other people. And so they don't have that support to carry them through the task, which is harder for them, of actually getting the work done. And so they often resist or avoid or, find ways to withdraw. And again, another contrasting difference is the difference between learning imitation and learning limits and learning facts, all important things, versus in DIR, learning autonomous or supporting autonomous thinking, negotiation, and exploration. Again, these are pretty well contrasted. I'm not going to talk about those next few slides if you're on the Circle Stretch blog. I'm just moving
Dr.
on to
Fugger,
what.
Dr. A couple people asked, are sending in emails asking to repeat the website because they missed hearing it.
It's circlestretch.blogspot.com. Circle Stretch is one word. One of our local moms came up with that. We're really proud of her for putting up this website for us.
Great.
Okay, and it should be the first. It's the first PowerPoint on there. So anyway, what does DIR look like? Well, it looks like floor time sessions, and we'll talk a little bit about those. But it also looks like floor time all the time, which is really always engaging the child in a flow of interaction, hopefully a balanced flow of interaction where there's a real back and forth where it's not just you entertaining the child, it's not just the child entertaining you. Some kids who have spectrum type difficulties are maybe verbal and talking at you, and you're trying to get a word in edgewise. That's not quite it either. You're always trying to figure out how to get a little bit more of a balance in that back and forth flow of interaction. It's really for all ages and all levels of challenge. We work with people who are young and old, not verbal at all, and maybe very challenged in terms of their motor abilities, motor planning abilities, sensory processing difficulties, visual spatial difficulties, receptive and expressive communication difficulties, and in their ability to, come up with ideas and execute those ideas. And at the same time, we also have people who are even adults who maybe haven't even been diagnosed before who were doing what almost looks like more of a traditional psychotherapy with, but who come in because they're having trouble at work or with their relationships, and it turns out that they're having similar difficulty with their affective flow of interaction, and so we work on a similar kind of model, using a similar kind of DIR model with them, and have found it to be helpful. DIR, when we are doing it as clinicians, and I would argue for parents too if you're doing this, always includes time to think and reflect about what you're doing, about what's working, and what to try next. In fact, really any good plan should involve that, and I hope you're nodding your head saying, well, of course, that makes sense. But most of the time, people don't take the time to sit back and think what's working, or they don't do it often enough. You might, again, in the U.S., do it at a IEP meeting once or twice a year or in an emergency setting, but in my practice, I like to be sitting and reflecting, and usually with somebody else, another brain in the room, every week or two. So if I'm consulting to a school, for instance, I'm talking with maybe my partner at that school, whether it's a teacher or maybe an aide or somebody, every week or two for some time about what's going on and how things are progressing and what we can do differently to try to make it go even better. So now breaking down the D, the I, and the R of all this, I want to talk a little bit about, what does it mean to be developmental? We have these functional, emotional, developmental levels that kind of condense many other developmental theories down to a set of foundational skills. But we're always most concerned with the connection of the child to others and how the child grows and learns and adapts using that all-important connection with others. So I want you to remember that this is all about social problem solving and, Fader's new rule as of the past couple weeks, there's always a social problem in the room. So if you go to the slide, if you have it, on functional, emotional, developmental levels, there's these nine different levels that Greenspan has come up with. The first six are actually incorporated into the Bayley scales for developmental evaluations. And they begin with co-regulation, or being calm enough to interact and alert enough to interact. So we figure that nothing can happen if you're not settled down enough. And that happens in child development in the first couple months of life. People kind of settle out a little bit. And then we move on to engagement. Again, in the next few months of infancy, this warm, bright, trusting connection that you hope is going to develop between parents or caregivers and their children. And it's something that is really crucial to any kind of interaction with anyone if it's going to go beyond something rote, beyond a didactic, question and answer, or beyond someone merely entertaining you or you entertaining them. So beyond that, you start with circles of interaction. Those start occurring, in infancy. You remember babies maybe dropping a toy, and you pick it up, and they drop the toy, and you pick it up, or playing peekaboo with you. These little bits of interaction that are emotionally charged. You can see it in the baby's face, and you can see similar circles of interaction with anybody, really, when you're having a real interaction with them. From there, we hope we're going to get a flow of interaction that leads to figuring out how to manage a situation. And again, what I'm bringing in is social problem solving, because if you move down to symbolic thinking and logical thinking in the next couple of steps, and mind you, those first six steps are usually mastered by about age four, certainly should be. We think about logical thinking sometimes as, my child can go out to the car, he can, he can steal the keys, get the door open, open the garage, get in the car, turn the ignition, and drive the car out. Not a good thing, but he can, quote-unquote, logically think through and even adapt to the challenges that are there, like getting through the locks or whatever. But that's not the kind of logical thinking that we're talking about. We're talking, although that's important to have, what we're talking about is logical thinking in the context of relating, solving the problem in the room, which usually is, I'm here, some other person's there. Are we going to relate to each other at all? Are we going to be able to create an interaction that's a learning interaction? And the same with symbolic thinking. A lot of times people will think of symbolic thinking as, you can use a peck, a picture exchange card with an icon on it, or maybe even a color on it, to know that that's a color, and you can point to these colors and you know these colors. You can point to a picture of a dog and you know it's dog, things like that. And that's sort of the beginning of symbolic thinking, but we're thinking about symbolic thinking in terms of social problem solving, meaning if I want juice, I might say juice because I asked for juice and we both understand the symbol, the language symbol that's juice, and it's kind of rudimentary, but we might also think of it in terms of nonverbal communication. A funny look can also have symbolic meaning, that look that sometimes a parent or a teacher gives a kid, kind of a raised eyebrow, where it's, if you do this, you're going to be in trouble. That's actually kind of a gestural, almost symbolic kind of thing, but and very rudimentary. What we're trying to move towards is symbolic thinking that moves you out of the immediate situation to be able to talk about or communicate about a situation so that you don't have to be living in it in the moment. And it's really important because if you have people who are tantruming or having, you know, all kinds of trouble in the moment, how do you get them out of that moment to be able to think about it and then do some planning for the future? And that requires symbolic thinking and then logical thinking. Beyond that, there are other steps, multi-causal, gray area, and reflective thinking I'm not going to spend much time on right now. But the way we boil it down to on our little circle stretch cards, again, is calm enough, co-regulation, engaged, that warm, bright, trusting connection, and then this flow of interaction that we're trying to get, the circles of interaction that are balanced and that kind of move you forward. You know, I go on in the PowerPoint to talk about our Likert scales for how we kind of rate each of those different developmental levels, social, emotional, developmental, you know, functional developmental levels. And I even give you a little sample FEDL, which shows an example of a child, you know, back in November of 05, 06, 07, and 08, how the child improved in regulation and engagement. And you can sort of see, you know, all these capacities slowly getting better, but the more difficult ones, symbolic function and logic, are getting better, you know, only very slowly. And then I have a little bit more description of what it means to be calm enough and connected, and circles and flows, symbols, things like that. Moving on to individual differences, what we mean by that is, you know, we're talking about sensory sensitivities and processing, postural control and motor planning, receptive communication and expressive communication. By that, I include visual, spatial as well. I include nonverbal, which is so, so important. I was actually at a talk this morning by someone giving a really nice talk about trauma and attachment, and as it relates to, you know, people with possible autism spectrum syndromes, if not autism. And you know, one of the nice points that this person made was that our nonverbal ability to relate to the environment and communicate usually develops before our verbal ability, and it becomes and is and remains really part and parcel of how we're going to live in the world. We believe nonverbal communication before we believe verbal most of the time, and in fact, when we have people who are quote-unquote high-functioning, who are talking a blue streak, most of the time it's the nonverbal difficulties that they have that are you know, getting in the way of their actually communicating and solving the social problem of the moment, whether that's getting along with peers or getting along with the teacher. And then praxis is another area we look at, knowing how to solve problems, the social problem of the moment again. And then I have a quick a grid that, again, comes from our FEDL, our Functional Emotional Developmental Capacity Rating System, that also spoke about the same kid who you saw a couple slides back in the sample, that just fleshes out some of the things that we look for specifically. And I've written in red the problematic areas, orange the places where, or actually red the things that aren't happening, in orange the problematic areas, and green the things that are going pretty well. And so you look at the individual child's profile, where are you now, what works, what are the details, and how do you help the child do better in these areas? We want relationships that are therapeutic with family and therapists, with teachers, with really everyone. And so we have to really look at the child's profile to figure out what gets in their way so that we can make those relationships work better. And a very quick example might be for a lot of people, you know, a lot of people we work with, they process auditory information rather slowly. And so they can't keep up with the rapid back and forth banter of, you know, the children around them. And if you merely slow it down, and, you know, maybe that's on your quick guide. I often do quick guides for kids, you know, for their teachers. Maybe it's just, you know, wait for the child to respond. Give them time to respond. It's worth the wait. That's enough to help the child be more connected. That's enough about the child's individual profile to make all the difference between a kid who's connected and a kid who's not connected and either withdrawn or frustrated and acting out. So moving on to the relationship part. We look at family circumstances and family styles. We look at the teacher's style and the class circumstances, class size, how noisy, the kinds of kids. We look at how much support there is, and we provide support to families, therapists, and the school. And we look at the importance of time. It's all misspelled. Time to think about how this is working. So, again, that reflective time to find out what you're doing and whether it's going well. The rest of this is all about how we work on better engagement and supporting the child's development. And so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it because we're going to answer your specific questions. But I talk about DIR at home, the focus time that we have, attention to those FEDL levels, doing whatever you can to expand on a child's idea, go with their ideas, play a little bit confused, maybe be a little bit obstructive but not too much, and working gently but persistently toward more complexity. So, you know, examples that I'm sure will come up tonight are, you know, when a child wants something, even something perseverative, what do you do? And gently leveraging that desire, and what do you do about bedtime and other limits and negotiating those. And the thing that I want you to remember is that in communication, nonverbal communication is really critical. Wooing is so important versus prompting, especially with things like eye contact. I don't tell people, look at me. I don't, you know, pull their face towards me with my hand. I do something that might catch their attention. And I try not to get caught in verbal interactions that have really very little connection. Things that I recommend people try to avoid are quizzing for facts, directing games, conversations, and play. I like to tell people, don't say the N-word. Don't say no. Try to think of every idea as interesting, even if it's, you know, crazy, violent, whatever. It's at least interesting, even if it's impossible to give the child what he or she wants. And you can sort of at least roll with the idea, even if you're not going to give in the end, so that you can get an interactive flow and so that the child can eventually understand and tolerate the limit better. Avoid entertaining the child, merely entertaining the child, and avoid following a child around without joining and shaping the interaction. Another big pet peeve of mine is to avoid questions. And we can't really avoid questions, but I want you to think about how questions are really very top-down. They're very much putting us in a very superior position to the child and isn't really teaching the child to think and to respond for himself, even if it's not verbal. They make the child more likely to shut down or maybe tantrum. I know it's hard to do not to ask questions, but think about it, practice it. You know, you can always email me and tell me what you think. But instead, I want you to talk about what's happening. Talk about the situation, what's going on here and now. And that puts the child or the other person, if it's an adult, in a position that's just a little bit above you so that they're doing the thinking. You can sort of be playing Sancho, the child's Don Quixote. You know, you're stating the situation. You're allowing the other person to come up with the solution. Again, it'll become more clear when we talk about some examples. At school, what we usually want is for kids to sit and work independently, learn, play, take turns, share. We're looking for compliance. And, you know, again, as I said before, when I think about why kids typically comply, it's because they're already engaged. So if they're not engaged in the process, if they don't have buy-in to the process, then you got to build that first before you're really going to get natural compliance where kids really want to playing by the rules that we need them to play by at school. In the IEP process in the U.S., we look at present levels of function, and I look at present levels of co-regulation, engagement, and reciprocity. I try to look at what works and what doesn't work and why that is. We look at these individual differences as strengths and challenges, and then we set up goals for these. And then the intervention should have the whole team focusing on engagement, and then the rest really falls into place. Engagement is the fulcrum for the entire intervention. If you're going for engagement, it requires that you get co-regulation. If you're going for engagement, that naturally leads to a flow of interaction or more circles of interaction than a flow of interaction and more development. We have tracking forms for that. And, of course, I emphasize reflective feedback. I know I'm going more than my 20 minutes, and I'll only take a few more minutes.
I know, Josh. I've got my stopwatch on here.
I know. I'm at 27 or 8 minutes.
Well, go ahead. Do you want to finish up?
Yeah, I'll finish up really fast. Although just in terms of supporting engagement at school, one point I want to make is that a lot of times people will give sensory breaks to kids, you know, if they're having OT difficulties, you know, sensory integration difficulties, and the occupational therapist will come in and they'll say, well, you know, maybe you need to go out and bounce around for a while. And my concern about that is that if all you're doing is you're kind of escaping to bounce around and then try to come back in, you're not necessarily learning how to function better in the situation. The example I would give is really for any of us. If you are engaged with somebody in an interaction and you're feeling kind of comfortable with it, you're usually able to tolerate things better. So I'll be kind of pushing the idea that let's just get that gleam in the eye, that connection with a few staff, and see if the child's tolerating the academic situation, whatever it is, maybe in small chunks, better and better and better. So first, you're kind of working with adults, and then you're working towards peers, with same-age peers usually being the toughest, because they're the ones who really can tell. I'm talking about typical peers. They can really tell that there's a difference. The younger peers and the older peers kind of cut you a lot of slack. I'm also a fan of Paula Kluth, who talks a lot about inclusion and how to make that work, and so I encourage people to take a look at her work on that. In school, in everyday life, we are working on everyday problems. We're working on keeping the child engaged. We're working on developing relationships between the child and staff. And examples that often come up at school have to do with, you know, seat work, playground facilitation, social skills groups. What do you do with a nonverbal child? Can you have a nonverbal child in a typical regular education classroom? And I would say, yeah. Can you have a highly verbal, rigid-thinking, perfectionistic child in a typical class and make it work? That's actually harder, I think. So we work on facilitating interactions. We work on facilitation with kids. I have some things that a facilitating adult might say. And I also have in here, and we can talk about it later, a general plan for the management of difficult moments that's based on Greenspan's talk that he gave actually last fall at the ICDL International Conference. That's really very, very helpful. There are DIR schools around the country, and there's a number of resources. As I said, Circle Stretch, if you're on it right now, it's got lots of forms and more detailed PowerPoints. ICDL.com has plenty as well, and I'm happy to go to your questions.
So this is a question for me right now, but do I take it from everything you've been saying that floor time is also considered helpful for teenagers and adults, even if they've never had access to it before?
Oh, absolutely. The way that one figures that out is, well, it's not if it's going to be helpful, it's sort of how is it going to be helpful. I mean, when you think about what do you want for your child and go from there, if all you want from your child is for the child to point to objects when you want them to do that, then floor time really is not for you. But if you're looking for something that will, you know, try to think about the child and the family as a whole, and try to move the child towards a, you know, hopefully more meaningful interactions and a more fun life, then I think it does a really, really nice job. And it's very broad. And, you know, when you say, oh, you know, this method is for everybody, you know, it sounds a little bit silly, you know, like almost anybody could say that. Like, I suppose the people who like hyperbaric, you know, chambers would say, you know, it's for everybody. But, you know, one of the reasons why I say that it's for everybody is it really comes out of the biopsychosocial medical model, which has been in play in general medicine for the past 30, 40 years almost, originally kind of promulgated by a guy named George Engel, who realized that people with, you know, who are having heart attacks were under a lot of stress and, you know, kind of figured out from there that if you look at, you know, the biologic piece as well as the thoughts that the person is having and also the environment that they're in, maybe the work environment, home environment, if you look at all the different levels of possible intervention, you could intervene in a variety of places. And, in fact, DIR is a biopsychosocial model where you're looking at the biological individual difficulties that the child is having. I haven't really talked about it today, but you know, we certainly look at the biomedical piece as well. But you're looking at their individual challenges. You're looking at what's happening with them psychologically, and then you're using this relationship-based, community-based kind of intervention to try to help them have, you know, kind of a richer and fuller life. And again, as I said, it's for everybody because biopsychosocial is meant to encompass everybody in the first place.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment before we go to the questions in that my son has not, up until now, benefited from any floor time, but it makes a lot of sense listening to you, my son's 20, because when you talked about the difference of using ABA or trying to woo someone into doing something, that's so much more important even as they get older. Because I'm sorry, you have a teenager or a 20-year-old, it's not just about ordering them around, that you have to have buy-in from someone who's bigger than you.
That's a really good point. And, you know, I work with a number of people who aren't particularly verbal, meaning not verbal, and big and older, and including older adults as well as some young adults. and that is a problem. You know, as people get older, if you can't figure out how to engage with somebody, you know, people get upset, and then they start often enough, you know, hitting and breaking things, and people get hurt. And one of the biggest worries that I have is for people who are at home, and believe me, I'm not a fan of institutionalization. I like to figure out how we can work out things at home or have a living situation that's wonderful. I can talk about those too.
Right.
But what I worry about is aging parents getting injured or God forbid killed by you know, kids who just don't understand, the adult children who don't understand, and they have become violent and injure them. And it happens often enough. I've been, you know, doing this since 1980, and I've seen it, unfortunately, way too many times. And it's the kind of thing when people start becoming violent where you start getting, you know, behavioral consultants coming in here from our regional centers, or we start, you know, using a lot of medications, things like that. But when you step back and look at what's really going on, if you're able to figure out how to engage with the person, or you find out the places in their lives where they're actually doing pretty well, what you'll find is that maybe just naturally they're not doing floor time because they're saying they're doing floor time, but you'll find that certain people just have a knack for connecting with that adult,
right,
and are able to,
right,
kind of co-regulate with them.
Right. It's really about the approach as well.
Very much.
Okay, we're going to go to some questions here. This one's from Kevin and Tina, White Grand Junction, Colorado. They're from Grand Junction, Colorado. You know, I'm going to slaughter people's names here, and I hope people don't get insulted. And, of course, when you see my name, you have to understand I would forgive you if you did the same to mine. So Kevin and Tina, their question is, how does floor time differ from ABA therapy? With floor time, doesn't someone just sit with the child and work on different things such as games, answering questions, building things, et cetera?
So, you know, again, you can go back to that PowerPoint that I was going through earlier, and there's actually a number of others that detail a little bit more, but the big difference between ABA and DIR is that ABA has, you know, kind of a list of things that you want someone to learn, and they're often very useful things, you know, how to ask for something, how to use the toilet, how to, you know, do those sorts of things, how to do a particular job. It's all of things that are very well defined that you can make sure that someone can do. You know if they're doing it right or doing it wrong. With DIR, you're remembering those things that you want a child to learn or the kinds of skills you want them to learn. So, for instance, if you want someone to I'll use an adult pre-vocational kind of example. If you have an adult who's not particularly verbal, not particularly violent, let's say, and who you want them to be a trash picker-upper in the parks, hopefully they're using gloves, they're having a nice time, it's outside, it's all, you know, very congenial, but you're telling a person, okay, pick that up, okay, pick that up, good job, here's your reward, here's your whatever it is, your candy or, you know, whatever it is for doing it. We get a lot of people who are just really resisting that. If instead, I think of, you know, specific people in an example, I have somebody who, you know, just really is resisting that sort of sorting kind of task, but who I'm instead taking a walk with them in the park, and we're playing around with the plants, and we happen to pick up a bag, and there's stuff we like and there's stuff we don't like, and it turns out the stuff we don't like we're throwing in the bag, and it turns out that that stuff is the trash, and we're kind of interacting with each other. Well, the whole thing is more like, you know, we're kind of co-creating it. And although I have an idea in my mind that, you know, whatever we're doing ought to be useful in the end, and maybe it didn't turn out to be picking up trash, maybe it turned out to be something else that was useful, we're doing it from the basis of an interaction, so we're building it together. And so there's real buy-in through the relationship, and that's really done with almost anything. If you do get the opportunity to read that article I wrote in the Autism File, it kind of follows a child from, you know, really preschool up through the end of high school and how one supports, you know, various kinds of interactions from the most simple playing with cars, but for the purpose of just trying to interact all the way to, you know, kind of working on term papers that have, you know, fairly complex concepts in them. So, again, I would say that ABA speaks more to tasks and limits and facts, and DIR speaks more to co-creating, exploration, autonomous thinking. And I could probably try to talk for hours about that. But
right.
But again, I'd encourage you to go back to those PowerPoints as well. There's also another talk there on Circle Stretch kind of contrasting DIR with RDI. And I would just add that RDI has some really lovely social cognitive concepts that people really need to know. I mean, when you're talking with someone, it really is important to share experiences with each other. And it speaks a little bit more to the high-functioning verbal people. The way that DIR would manage that is somewhat different in that instead of sort of teaching someone we should be both sharing our experiences, we work from the other person's experience. We wonder about their experience. We try to join them and co-create an interaction that's making just what they're saying more complex, and then maybe in appropriate context adding in a little bit of ourselves and more as time goes on. So it's more bottom-up. It's more building the skill with them in an experiential fashion as opposed to RDI does a little bit more top-down teaching the skill in a more, somewhat more didactic fashion. So they're complementary, but really quite different. And I would put RDI closer to a behavioral model because of that.
Right. Okay, Diana from Orange Park, Florida asks, I would like to know how floor time could help reduce or eliminate scripting. My five-year-old is gaining more language each day, just not as much expressive. Scripting just makes him totally tune us out, and we cannot get his focus. We are starting soon with an OT that uses floor time in her sessions. Any help or suggestions now would be appreciated.
I think that's a great question. It kind of speaks to something I alluded to earlier. How do you join somebody in something and then make more of it, even if it's something that's perseverative? And scripting is, you know, a classic example. So I'm not sure. Maybe she'll email in and you'll know more a specific example. But I know plenty of kids who will memorize language from like the movie Cars or Toy Story or something like that, and they'll just want to be, you know, kind of telling you the story in your ear or at you, or even demanding that you say, you know, specific dialogue in a certain way, and then they say specific dialogue in a certain way. And there's a number of ways to deal with this, and certainly the more behavioral type approach could include extinguishing it by totally ignoring it, or rewarding when the child isn't doing it, or, you know, maybe even giving the child consequences for using it. Oh, well, you know, you didn't earn whatever it was, you know, those kinds of things. And in floor time, this is another great difference between a behavioral approach and a DIR floor time approach. In floor time, what we would do is we would be really curious about the script, and we would play a little bit dumb. And, you know, so if I'm being told to be, you know, a Woody or something in Toy Story, and I'm supposed to say, you know, whatever, a Buzz Lightyear, and I'm supposed to say to infinity and beyond. And I wouldn't just, you know, stonewall the kid and say, I'm not going to say that necessarily. And I wouldn't necessarily be so dumb about it that it's not believable. But I might say a little bit different. I might whisper, I might say, to infinity and beyond, you know, I just do it a little bit wrong. Or I would certainly take the role if I could and then do something a little bit more with it. I might fall down instead of, you know, pointing my finger up. You know, it's some way to join it, but to expand on it just a little bit so that it's just a little bit different every time. And so when you get into the script and you're able to, over time, expand on that script so that it becomes more and more and more varied and flexible, then you're really kind of cooking along. So what you don't want to be doing is you don't want to be merely following the script, because that isn't floor time. We talk, if you read a lot of floor time things, you hear about following the child's lead. Well, that's the lead. The lead means the very beginning of what the child presents. Every idea is a good idea. But that doesn't mean you just do that idea constantly all the time. It means you take something and you do something a little bit with it, a little bit different every time, a little bit more flexible. Another great example is kids who do Legos and are really good at that, and, you know, they can just put them together almost with their eyes closed. They're very complex, and they just want to put them together. And what you try to turn that into is, you know, you might hoard the Legos so that they have to get them from you, so at least you're part of the interaction. And or once the thing is built and then it starts crumbling apart, you can start maybe putting it together a little bit in different ways, slightly different ways, and maybe the kid puts it right back to the way they wanted it. But you're trying to do it in a playful, gleam-in-the-eye way, not in a mean way. And it takes, frankly, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of time. And Greenspan would say, 6 to 8 sessions a day of 20 minutes of time is often, very, very helpful. Maybe not just one caregiver doing that because that's nearly impossible. But plenty of time spent doing that with maybe a couple
different
people.
Can you repeat the amount of time?
Oh, repeat the amounts of time. So, again, Greenspan would often say 6 to 8 sessions per day of about 20 minutes of just really doing floor time. And then in all the other interactions, trying to be engaged as much as possible, which is very different from, for instance, a behavioral approach where you work someone for a while and then you reward them by letting them self-stimulate for a time so that they can get a break. Here, we're not really looking to, quote, give the kid a break in which they just stim, because that just, well, it doesn't really get them anywhere, and it probably makes them more stiff in terms of being able to work with them. When I think of a break, say a break with a toy or a break with a computer, that should be a break with another person with that thing, so that even though it's a fun thing that they like, it's a fun thing that's also part of an interaction. And so you might ask, doesn't the kid ever get time to be alone? The answer is, of course they do, because they always do, because we can't keep that up. But but it's still nevertheless, important to understand that if you give someone a break, a sensory break, a computer break, a gaming break, usually you pay for that in spades. You usually end up having more trouble with the kid later. But if those breaks, to the extent possible, are with other people are engaged and interactive. So instead of the break is from doing homework or math or something, and you're out, taking a walk or doing something, but it's with somebody, you're going to be better off. And, of course, it's impossible. You can't possibly fill every minute of the day, and there are single parents, and there's all kinds of people who can't possibly do that. All I'm saying is you keep your eye on the ball and you try to do it as much as you can, because it works better that way than to say, he needs a break, we're just going to let him have a break.
Right.
Now, you have to sort of be honest, intellectually honest about it, and say, I need a break. That's valid. Of course we do.
That's us older parents.
Yes, us older parents. We need a break.
Okay, so I'm going to move along, because we have so many questions, you wouldn't believe how many questions. I'm going to ask you one that's from Alyssa in Toronto. How would you suggest approaching attention-seeking behaviors, such as screaming or crying? In ABA, they would suggest extinction. What would the DIR method be for decreasing this kind of behavior?
Another great question. They're all really good. We should have 5 hours for this, not two.
No.
So when somebody is crying for, say, attention, they just kind of want you, that's really a good thing. They're crying because they didn't get what they wanted, and they think that the crying is going to get you to get it for them. In a way, that's a marvelous thing. We turn this around in DIR. We think, that means the child understands that something they do can get you to do something. It's a little bit a theory of mind when you think about it. But obviously, we don't want the kid just crying and screaming. We want them to develop a better negotiating capacity. So, again, every idea is a good idea. They're crying for, we probably figured out what they're crying for, they want candy. They want it now. They're demanding it. And my response is, candy, that's a great idea. Wouldn't that be great? Now, I know that dinner's coming up, but we have to find out not if but when we can have something resembling candy. They're still crying. It doesn't always work and not all the time, but over time, if you're going with the idea and working with it, you're going to find that you can give something some time and you're always giving attention. So it's the absolute opposite of ABA, isn't it? You're giving attention, but you're not giving attention in a way that's screaming at the child. You're not giving attention in the way that's just giving into the child. You're giving attention to the child's idea and trying as best you can, and it takes time. It's not an overnight process. Working with that idea a little bit so that you're trying to be somewhat empathic. And one of the things that you can also do, especially with a child who's upset or angry, is sometimes what you want to be doing is you want to be figuring out how to best counterbalance the child's upsetness. So sometimes being very calm in the storm is helpful. You can experiment. Sometimes nearly, not fully, but nearly matching the child's level of intensity in their anger or their crying or sadness is really very helpful because they're feeling a little bit more understood, and then you can kind of slowly kind of talk them down, step them down from what's happening. So a good example is something happened that a child didn't expect. That happens all the time. I could talk for an hour about expectations, but I'll just give you Fader's rule, it's not my rule. I got it from somewhere else. But basically nothing ever happens as we expected. The way that I gave my little spiel at the beginning didn't happen as I expected. Nothing happens as we expect. But we talk a lot about, in the field of autism, about making sure things are predictable for children because you want them to be able to know what to expect, because if not, they'll be upset. Well, I would argue that, you know, you don't want to change everything every day. That would drive everybody crazy. But you don't want things to be exactly the same either, because, A, you can't do it, and, B, the person only gets more constricted the more you try to make things the same. It happens with people with obsessive compulsive disorder as well, who try to get you to do things the same, say the script the same, and do it more in a more and more constricted fashion until everybody's so constricted they can't go out, they can't do this, they can't do that. Happens the same with, you know, people who are perseverative and demanding in autism, if we're only trying to make everything, you know, meet their expectations. So
right.
I will get to more to the point of the crying. I'm sort of fitting a lot of things in here with it. But the point is that we can never actually meet somebody's expectations anyway. Like if you just go and you give the cookie all the time, you'll get it wrong somehow. So rather than giving in, or rather than just rebuking or ignoring, we work with the idea. We work with it a little bit differently every time. So this time it's, so you want another cookie. Or it's, another cookie. Well, that's an interesting idea. I mean, you're always doing it a little bit different and trying to work with it a little. And when somebody's very upset, sometimes it's, you do want another cookie. I can see you seem so hungry for that. You really do want it. And you know, to be real about it, I mean, the child really does want it, and you really do feel for the child because it's not a good thing. They're in distress. There really is empathy there, hopefully, on your part. But you're not going all the way to where they're at, because then you'd just be tantruming alongside them, and that doesn't help anything. However, if they can pick up on and read a little bit your level of concern, then hopefully they come down to your level of concern, and they believe you, and hopefully you'll be a believable person when you say, we want to figure out when you can have that. I wish I could give it to you now, but you know, maybe we can do that later after dinner, or whatever it is the child wants. So you're trying to negotiate that. So your first step, and this kind of goes back to the whole aggression thing that I alluded to in the PowerPoint as well, your first job is actually to soothe the child. And then when you can, when the child's a little bit settled down, to talk about what was going on, if that's possible, or play about it if the child can play, or if they're not verbal at all, you may be doing other things. But usually the child has some investment in it, so if they're able to communicate or play about it, they can. And then from there, once you understand more what was going on from their point of view, then you can maybe plan for, well, how will you manage this for whatever the situation is, solving it now and maybe next time. And then when you predict that situation is coming up again, of course, in behavioral work, we're always talking about antecedents and rewards. So if you can anticipate an antecedent coming on, like, oh, it's getting close to bedtime and bedtime's always tough, you can be thinking about what your plan is to manage it, and also even be talking about the child. And oftentimes we're talking about, you know, giving kids warnings, you know, it's almost bedtime, or using one of those great time timers that, you know, counts down the minutes so that people know that it's almost time to do whatever they need to do. But another way to do that is also to, you know, be frank with the kid. You know, I know it's going to be bedtime in 20 minutes, and I know that you're usually not happy about that. And just be kind of stating the problem And who knows, maybe the kid will solve that problem for you. That's often the case. You're putting yourself in a little bit of that one down position, and you're anticipating it with them, and the kid is solving it for you and with you.
Okay, here's one from Vedrana from Split in Croatia. I work with a 10-year-old boy with PDD, NOS, and I do not know what to do when he throws things. He's doing this often and without reason.
Well, you know, lots of times without actually evaluating or knowing a lot more, it's hard to know exactly what to do with that. But whenever I think of throwing, I think of where are you throwing it to and can you give it direction? So lots of people throw, and sometimes they're throwing stuff at us, and that's not good. If they're doing that, quote-unquote, for attention, you know, in contrast to crying and screaming, which hopefully isn't hurting anybody, then there's, you know, throwing, which could be problematic. If it's that kind of a moment, then we're talking again about soothing and trying to talk about it and get a plan together later. But, you know, sometimes what you can do is just try to remember that in your interactions with the child, if you're always working towards co-regulation, you know, that, you know, trying to help the child be calm enough with you in the moment, the engagement, going for that gleam in the eye, trying to do things that help the person know that you're there, you're with them before all the throwing starts, and having these circles of interaction, if the throwing is caused basically from frustration, well, you're kind of dealing with the frustration. If, on the other hand, it's more like, you know, this is what the child really likes to perseverate on and do, I think about, well, what can we be throwing? I would be giving them things to throw. They would be soft objects. They might even be Kleenex. I did a Kleenex throw with somebody the other day, and I would probably be giving them some directionality for it. So, oh, you're going to throw it. You know, I might be holding a trash can or a bucket or a hat or something for them to be throwing it at. If someone has a head cold and they're, you know, perseverating on their Kleenex, I might be giving them a trash can to throw the Kleenex at, and then I might be giving them clean Kleenex all balled up to throw in the trash can, and then I might be expanding that to giving them, I'm big on these terry cloth washcloths. I have a bunch of them in my office because you can use them for a million things, and I'm not here using them for Kleenex, but, you know, I'll knot that up and let them be throwing that at a hat or something, and then, you know, all of a sudden, we've got a game of, you know, throwing something and tossing it back and forth, when what we had before was this just sort of uncontrolled, all over the place, God knows where this is going sort of situation. So, you know, based on the situation, there's different things you might do with it, but engagement is really, again, the fulcrum. You want to try to be engaging someone so that they're less frustrated if they're doing it out of frustration. And if they're doing it more out of perseveration, it's sort of what they do and what they like. You want to be helping them form it into something that's kind of interesting, kind of useful, and certainly safe.
Right. Okay, here's Mike from Long Island. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, this one's kind of long because he explains things. He's a teacher, ABA teacher here from New York. I implement a lot of neat lessons within my ABA sessions. I have over the years learned that it is crucial to initially pair well with my students. I always say that rapport is 80% of my job. Getting that social connection underway has helped in establishing a consistent learner in each student I teach. This then helps solidify the generalization process. Question. In a 90-minute ABA session, how much time do you think would be an effective time span to add floor time to my ABA-DT, you know, discrete trial work? I feel both can work well hand in hand.
Okay, the answer is 90 minutes. but, you know, I want to speak to the first part of his question first. I have a colleague, I don't know if she's listening tonight, I think some of her colleagues are, Aubyn Stamer. She's a researcher and developmental psychologist here in San Diego at Rady Children's Hospital. And when I've seen her do ABA, I want to be that child. Because like this, like Mike is saying, you know, when the rapport is there, it's beautiful. If you watch Lovaas, you know, the man, doing ABA kind of work, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's lovely. If you read Annabelle Stelly's book, Sound of a Miracle, and you hear about how ABA really helped the child, what I'm hearing between the lines is how the speech therapist interacted with the child and had rapport. And I think, Mike, you're right that rapport is truly the key to the child complying with the ABA, and generalizing out. And I hope that rapport includes a flexibility so that, you know, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I say you should have 90 minutes of floor time in your ABA, in your 90-minute ABA session, but not really, because my hope is that although, you know, ABA would tell you, for instance, if you're teaching a child to put in, that you clear the decks and don't have extraneous kinds of things there that you don't want, and that you say it the same way every time. Put in. Or when you want the child to say something to you, you try to make sure that they're saying it the quote-unquote appropriate way each time. Turn the page, say green. You know, it's always got to be the same. But in, you know, the way that I think about it is if the child actually learns to do it that way, they're not going to be adaptive. So they might be able to say turn the page in a situation where it's useful, but it always comes out weird. And so if what your goal is for the person to be more and more able to function in kind of typical society, you actually want turn the page to sound a little bit different every time. So it kind of goes back to expectations and, you know, making things the same versus flexibility, and you got to kind of build it in. So when I say 90 minutes of ABA needs to be 90 minutes of floor time, my hope would be that you're butchering the ABA by saying turn the page a little bit differently, or put in. You know, and you know, again, I'm not sure that telegraphic speech like that is always the most useful way to do it, but I'd at least be changing the affect, changing my facial expressions, making it flexible enough so that the child has those interactions. Now, more to the point of your question, when you ask, you know, in a 90-minute ABA session, how much floor time could I get in and make that sort of a useful thing, what I would say, if you're actually going to cut out time to do floor time, meaning following the child's lead, doing things with them, is I would think about what you're doing right now. Right now, you're probably doing a bunch of trials, and you're kind of keeping track of the data, and then you're giving the child a break to do something. And what I would first start experimenting with is finding things that you can do a break with the child that aren't the child, that don't involve the child being alone in whatever it is they're doing, but involve you being part of that interaction. And then you'll probably find that that time that the child spends in breaks grows, and you might even find that they do their trials better, they comply more, so that they have more time to spend in floor time. And so they're getting their work done really fast because they're creating and doing things with you that are ever more interesting to them, and they're more engaging, and they're actually learning. And you can fold in those same concepts. If you're working on prepositions with the kid, in, up, down, around, it's not like you don't use those in floor time. You use them all the time, and you use those to expand your interaction. So if that's what the child's learning about, it's kind of like, you know, if they have to write a paper for English and they love rockets, you let them write it on rockets. If you're studying prepositions and you're trying to do, you know, trials on prepositions, well, maybe when you're just goofing around with the kid and you're playing with them, and you're maybe, you know, you've playfully stolen their ball or something, and they want it back, you're like, all right, do you want it up or you want it down, you know, or under or over, you know, how you're getting it back to them. So you're working with the same concepts so that they're real and so that they actually are used in a symbolic fashion, rather than just learning that put in is this little cube in that little thing and having more trouble with the generalization. So again, back to your original point, your rapport is crucial, and I would say folding in the floor time means taking the time that you usually would have had for reward stimming, allowing them to, you know, have time for themselves, to figuring out if you can create a playful interaction within that time, and then letting that expand so that, and what you don't want to do is you don't want to be so rigid about it that you have to just try to get more and more ABA goals in because the child's complying more, because that's like, you know, they're not really working for, it's like a never-ending loop for the kid. You wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't want, if you got all your work off your desk and you had time to do what you want, you wouldn't want your boss to say, oh, because you got all that work off your desk and you have time, I'm giving you more work. You wouldn't want to do it that way.
You know, I actually quit a job because somebody did that to me. I was hired to make educational films here in San Diego, and so I finished up this really big project because I wanted to have more time in the summer with my kids. And all he did, my boss, was move up the date that he wanted my next film due. And I thought, this guy has got to learn about behavior modification. Because all he managed to do was get me to quit.
Not working,
but
not good.
Anyway.
Well, Mike, I hope that was helpful.
Yeah. But it makes sense. I like that idea of starting in small bits, you know.
I think that's the way most people have to do this. You know, when someone walks into a consult and walks out with a recommendation of 20 minutes 8 times a day, that's just a little depressing and overwhelming. And I think, you know, what you really need to do is, for a clinician, it's good to get to know the child, to see a little bit about what works, and really try to find out what works for the child and caregivers, because they're the people who are, you know, with the child most, and then try to support that in little ways and expand on it over time. And it would be great. I mean, you know, in my dreams, families would come in and they'd say, oh, we're just going to do this all the time. And occasionally it happens. But most of the time that's not the case. Most people have been exposed mostly to ABA or other things, and they come in with these books of facts, and they show me how their child can point to the bunny or point to the dog, and they're so proud. And it's a good thing. You need to know how to point to a bunny and point to a dog, but it doesn't go very far. If, you know, you don't really know much about bunnies, otherwise you can't enjoy a dog.
So now there's a couple of people here who are asking questions which are pretty similar, so I'm going to read them both because they're both about trying to get floor time in their school.
Mm.
So Holly from North Carolina, I think this approach in the classroom would be beneficial. How often do you really see this happen in a classroom? I can really say that teachers here in North Carolina will not allow a therapist to come in and show them how to do this. They will feel belittled. How do you get around that? That's the first question. I'm going to go ahead and read the second one since they're kind of similar. Krista from Sherwood, Oregon. I'm trying to get my son's school teachers on board with floor time. They come from an ABA background. Floor time doesn't have the same scientific base that ABA does according to the school district. However, this approach is doing wonders for my girl. My son is in a special ed classroom. From what the teachers have seen of floor time, they think they are doing it, but they aren't. How can I best work with them to get them to understand how to apply floor time in my son's school day? What specific things can I do or resources can I direct them to? So both of them are wondering, how do they get floor time used in the classroom without their teachers or the people who are working with their children feeling belittled?
These are great questions. And, you know, most people who are, you know, in the field of working with kids with autism, including me, got their original training in behavioral methods. I mean, I did behavioral work for a number of years before I kind of went beyond it. And you know, teachers, look, you know, my mom was a teacher. There are a lot of teachers in the world. You really can't go into teaching without having the idea that you're going to teach people. And that you know what is going on and you have something to offer. And so when somebody comes into your class, which you love and which you're trying to take care of, and says, I know better than you, you're right. I mean, it's just impossible. So I usually get called in first when there's problems. You know, the things that aren't working for others, kids aggressive, spitting, whatever. And so somebody's calling me, and usually it's a parent, it's not a school typically. But schools are very gracious in terms of sharing with me, you know, what's going on, their concerns, the things that they're doing to try to manage it. And maybe it's because I'm a psychiatrist. They say, okay, doc, what do you think? What can you do? And I think some of the time they're thinking, can you give them a pill? That'll make this all better. And when I come back and say, well, this is really interesting. I really like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, when I do this, when you do this, this seems to really get them going and really work. And I wonder how you would, you know, I keep myself one step below them, and I think, I wonder how you would do more of that, or I wonder how to do more of that. I'm not sure how. Maybe you know better. And then they start thinking creatively in the direction that it's helpful, because these are things that you're not lying to them. You're talking about the things that are working, and you're kind of shaping, sort of behavioral thing, you're shaping them in a direction of, and respectfully shaping them in a direction that's going to move towards the kinds of things, you know, the co-regulation, engagement, reciprocity. That's ideal when you can do it that way. And the way that I personally do it a lot of times, as I may have alluded to, I like to have somebody who's at a school who's open-minded, and I'm working with them on a fairly regular basis and giving them a place to talk with me about how things are going, and I'm giving them lots of support and attaboys. But I'm a professional. I'm not doing that as the parent. So that makes a difference. You know, it's much harder for a parent to do that. So it's helpful to have a parent who can a professional who can help work with the school, and that's certainly not the case in a lot of situations. So as a parent, if you find that floor time or DIR kinds of practices are working for your child, honestly, the way in the end to get this done, so to speak, is to persistently request it. Some would say demand it. Some would say go to court. And then you run into the canard, really, of quote-unquote no scientific information. And then I would offer that you can go to Circle Stretch. You can download some of the stuff on the research basis for DIR, and it's huge. It is the entire child development literature that supports a relationship-based intervention to learning and intervention, the entire child development literature, plus all this other supporting literature from other fields, plus, you know, there are studies. So when people say there aren't, well there are. So it's fun to say, you know, there's no research behind it. But there actually is, and it's growing. It would be nice if there was more. There's a little bit of an analogy to long-term psychotherapy where, you know, long-term psychotherapists aren't very good researchers, and so it's taken a long time to kind of show what we knew from case studies for a long time, which is that it actually is pretty darn helpful and saves lives, et cetera. The other thing is if a teacher or a class says, oh, we're doing that, we're doing floor time, they actually aren't, because if you say you're doing floor time and you're a parent and you're doing that with your child and you've read some books and done some things, you actually might be, and I hope you are. In fact, we're trying to spread this information, obviously, by doing things like this, by making information available on the, you know, websites, things like that. We hope you'll do it. We hope you'll try it out. But if somebody says professionally we're doing floor time, unless they're certified, they're not. And chances are they're not in one of the most important pieces of floor time in DIR, which is a relationship with somebody who is certified, who's working with them on doing better. So if they say they're doing it, they actually aren't. And, of course, you don't want to just say, well, you're not doing it because you're not certified. But sometimes you'll go to a meeting and you'll have to politely say, well, gee, I thought that, you know, to do something like floor time, you needed certification, or you need to be in a certification relationship. And certification certainly is available. We have courses. We have an online course through ICDL that's available that I encourage people to go to ICDL.com and consider taking. It's what it costs, maybe a couple hundred bucks for, I think, 15 hours of lectures, and there's self-assessments and things like that to get you started. So there is, that's not exactly certification, but there's certainly learning and tutoring and then a certification process available. And I should say just a little bit more about the certification process for clinicians. It's not a kind of thing where you go for a weekend and then you're certified. It's a kind of thing where you do it for, 7-8 years, and you go back and you present cases and you're talking with people about it and you're problem solving, and in stages you become closer to certification. So it's a process for clinicians. It's not an overnight kind of thing. So getting back to, you know, how do you get it into the schools? Read those PowerPoints. There's one called DIR in the Schools, actually, on Circle Stretch. But you ask, you persist, you give some information, but what you mostly do, if you have a good relationship, is you find what works in the class. You understand whether that is or isn't. Hey, look, I'm pragmatic. I actually don't care if someone's using DIR or floor time if a kid is getting better. But find what's working, and if floor time is part of what's working, and you find little glimpses, a hundredth of the day that's working in the class, and you say, oh, that's a moment where he kind of connects. You can point that out. Gee, that's a moment where he kind of connects. I wonder if we can build on that. How do you think we can build on that? And let them be the experts to teach you, and they'll be teaching themselves how to make that work, you know, more and more over time. Again, in terms of resources, ICDL.com, Circle Stretch, the online course, those are some of the many things. There's certainly a lot of books you can buy on this, and I'm actually one of the people on the ICDL Schools Committee. We're trying to work on kind of a network of people who are interested in getting this into the schools. So you could certainly stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, there are at least four DIR-based schools in the U.S. Most, you know, they're on the East Coast, in Atlanta and in the New York area. And again, they're listed in that PowerPoint. And you could contact those schools, look at their websites, and you can see how they're applying DIR every day in class. And I have teachers who are doing it. Again, with help, everyone needs support and reflection, but we got teachers who are doing it.
Okay, here's a great question from Anna P. in New York. How can you use floor time therapy with a nonverbal autistic girl who does not show interest in any particular toy or object?
Great question.
How do you work with nonverbals, I guess?
Yeah. Well, but it's even more than that. It's someone who's not showing any apparent interest in anything at all,
right,
in any object. And look, you know, I didn't make this stuff up. Greenspan did. And certainly any butchering of it is mine and mine alone. So if Stanley, you're listening to this and I'm messing it up totally, I take all credit for all mistakes. But I will try to do my best to quote Greenspan, but also, you know, even in my own experience, when you have somebody who you think isn't doing anything, they actually are doing something. If they are doing anything at all, as Greenspan would say, even rubbing a piece of the carpet, they're actually doing something. And he has a beautiful vignette that he's described in probably in more than one of his books, where he has a child who's doing just that, who's kind of rubbing a piece of the carpet, and he's gently putting his hand in the child's way, gently, and the child moves his hand, and that's the first interaction. And so doing those kinds of things gently over and over and over again, but making them more and more complex, and then, you know, after 20 or 30 of those, the child looks up at him and kind of, you know, half smiles, then you know you got something going. What Greenspan would say is that he has never met a child he couldn't figure out how to engage with. I don't know if I would be quite so bold, because there have certainly been times when I've met people who are just so dysregulated, so out of control that, you know, I've been unable to successfully do a whole lot with them, you know, meaningful with them. So it's happened to me anyway, but then I'm not Greenspan. But nevertheless, what I would say is, you know, I always try to figure out, what are they doing? They're doing something, even if they're not attached to an object. Now, if they are attached to an object, it's a lot easier, because you can do something with the object sort of very playfully, joining or getting in the way a little bit and becoming part of the interaction. But if they're not, they're probably doing something. And again, you know, I give the Kleenex example, because if somebody's just, you know, blowing their nose because they have allergies and it's just really a hard day for them, you can even turn that into something. Even if they're not particularly interested in any toys or objects, and build on it, kind of like what I described earlier. So I think it's possible. I think the way to look at it is the cup is half full, not the cup is half empty, meaning they're always doing something. What is it they're doing? I guess, you know, when it comes right down to it, people are always breathing. I don't think I would get in the way of their breathing, but I might put a Kleenex in front of their nose and watch it move and see if they pay attention to it moving. I might do something like that. But I really try to use what they're doing as a lead, so to speak, as opposed to merely introducing something new if I can. On a bad day, I'll probably introduce something new just because that's what I do. You know, I'm a physician, so I'm doing weights and blood pressure, so I have to introduce some of those things. And so
right,
a kid comes in and he wants to do something and I want to, or he's just sitting there and then I have to impose. But usually I do that apologetically. You know, boy, you've got a better idea, and I got to do this blood pressure, and then the kid comes up. That's not the nonverbal kid you're talking about, but just in general, you're trying to figure out what the child is doing and go with whatever that is, try to join whatever that is.
Okay, here's Shmarlia from India. I really wanted to try this approach with my son, but no matter how much I try, I am unable to move beyond a certain point. If I take the initiative and start a game, my son is interested only to be on the audience side, and if I join with him in what he is doing, even though he does not have a chance, or he seems not to like it very much. The only thing he will respond to with a bright face is while I chase him and while I tickle him. During both these times, he does respond with a smiling face, good eye contact, and manding through gestures, both anything else I try, either he prefers to be on the audience side or just not interested. What do you think I should do?
Again, you know, I can't tell you exactly what to do without evaluating your child, blah, blah, blah. That's the medical defense. But what I can say is I can almost imagine the situation because I've been in it so many times, myself and with families. And I would try to think about how do you creatively expand on the chase. When you think about it, there are a lot of jobs in this world that are over-glorified chases. A neighbor of mine is a U.S. federal marshal. He chases bad guys for a living. Now he sits behind a desk, but he actually chased them for real. And there's also, there's just all kinds of jobs, detective work, all kinds of things that are really just glorified chase games. So I don't want to be pejorative because your child isn't doing very much and you're probably not thinking of your child as a future police detective. However, the point I'm trying to make is that you probably can think about the chase game in a way that's a little more creative, a little bit more hide-and-seek-ish. You're chasing me and, I'm under a blanket, or I'm chasing you and I've hidden you. Now I can't find you. So even if the child doesn't naturally play hide-and-seek, and even if the child doesn't really want to chase you, just wants you to chase him, you can still hide the kid under a blanket and say you've lost him and you're looking around searching. He'll probably peek out from under, giggle, and then you'll find him, and then you'll be playing sort of a half game of hide and seek. And then from there, just try to make it more interesting, more complex. Try to get as subtle as you can with your gestures and giggles, and try to get as varied as you can with your gestures and giggles, and even try to get intense, see what takes you over the top and what doesn't. So I think you can probably expand on what you have at the very least. And if you have the luck, you can also turn chase into other kinds of things. So if for instance, your child eats, you know, at the table with you, and however they eat, you could be chasing the kid, but you could also be using the same affect and giggles and chasing their food if it's a little bean that's rolling around. And you're like, it got away. The same voice like, you know, when the child got away. And it's sort of symbolic. That would be great, you know, if you can sort of move it into other areas so that other pieces of life can have a similar kind of joy, then you're kind of on your way. So it's a matter of really piecing together what you have. Again, the cup is half full, not half empty, and trying to work with that and expand on that. And then find other ways. I mean, you'll need to be creative. Find other ways where you could similarly use the same kinds of emotions and interactions, even if the food got hidden in his mouth. Or, hey, where did that go? You know, hey, where did you go? Hey, where did that food go? You know, you can do things like that, and with luck, he'll start to get those connections, and it'll be, you know, kind of fun. In terms of the other interactions, the things you try to join him at or you know, those kinds of things, it's a little bit harder to answer specifically to that. But I would say that, you know, we may well have ICDL people in India. I'm not sure. If we don't, you can probably contact somebody who's willing to come out there because we have people going, you know, at least to the Middle East and I think also to Asia, but I'm not sure India just yet. But it'll happen. Email me. Maybe you can have me out there. I'd love to visit.
Okay, this one's from Kristen in Carlsbad, a little closer and less exotic, but important nonetheless. I'm a new occupational therapist working in a pediatrics clinic with most of my caseload falling on the spectrum. I'm wondering, how do I use the floor time approach, completely client-centered from my limited understanding, when using sensory integration? I'm having difficulty understanding as most of my kids would never choose activities or equipment that could benefit them.
I'm not sure I fully understood the question, but it sounds like she's asking, or he's asking, about using floor time while using kind of sensory integration-based approaches to occupational therapy. So, for instance, maybe
right.
Using like swings and things like that. And we have actually in San Diego a number of, well, nationwide and certainly in San Diego, a number of occupational therapists who use floor time as the kind of the basis, the bedrock for what they're doing, even in their sensory integration work. And so just like with the ABA prepositions and things like that, folding into, you know, floor time sessions, it's very similar with sensory integration kinds of work. So, for instance, if you have somebody who, you know, you're working on, I don't know, vestibular kinds of problems or even balance kinds of difficulties, maybe that's, you know, I'm not an OT, I'm not going to pretend to be one, but let's pretend for the moment that you have someone who has, you know, very poor core postural control. So, you know, they kind of fall over and they can't pay very good attention that way and they can't interact very well. Well, if you are trying to interact with someone and get them to be more able to have that postural control, sometimes when you're providing them, as you know, as an OT, when you're providing them with multisensory input, they might be able to do it better. So, for instance, you have a kid who's a little bit floppy, can't quite do very well. You're trying to tell them, okay, get on that balance beam, do pretty well. And you're maybe giving them some visual cueing as well as maybe just, you know, one finger for them to touch onto your finger so they can have a little bit of balance. One of the pieces that will help organize their entire system, their nervous system, so that they can be better able to do what you want them to do and be interested in doing it is, in fact, engaging with them in a manner that they care about the interaction with you. And so not that they're going to, quote, do it for you as the coach, but they're just kind of having fun with you, and so you're naturally doing some of these things. So in your interactions with the child, you might start with wherever the child's at. The child's flopped over on a couch, all right. So you're flopped over with them, kind of joining them. And then maybe you are doing a little bit more with some of these kids in terms of, you know, kind of starting to swing with their arms a little bit and then swinging them up a little bit, and they're a little bit more upright, and then you're rocking back and forth. I'm actually doing this with a headset on right now as I'm talking. You know, kind of rocking back and forth, holding hands back on your heels and getting a little bit more balance that way, and maybe moving, almost dancing together a little bit. I mean, the idea, the image I'm trying to create for you is one where you're joining the child, and then you're interacting with the child, and then you're wooing the child into an interaction which is kind of fun and which also incorporates the kinds of things that you're working on. And because it's kind of fun for the child, they're more able to organize themselves and do the things that you want them to do. By contrast, when someone goes into their session, so to speak, and they're being, quote-unquote, non-compliant, lots of times, what you find when you look at it more closely is that the child is being told to do this, do that, do that, do that. You're kind of checking off things on a list because they really do need to do these things. You know, get your hands into those, you know, gooey things. You got to do it, you got to do it, you got to get used to it. And it's hard, but they eventually get used to it. But, you know, if there isn't the engagement there, it's a lot harder work, and it's not necessarily a fun and interesting experience for the child to figure out all about GUI and to enjoy that and to get better
right.
postural control and to enjoy that and, you know, really do things in the context of a relationship that makes it more fun and frankly, more meaningful and more functional and more generalizable. So I guess the bottom line answer is floor time is amazing when done in OT. And I'd also invite you, since you're in Carlsbad, if you haven't been in touch with us, we have free professional support groups every month. Our next one is March 4th from 9 to 10:30 down here in Solana Beach at my office, 415 North Highway 101. And we're going to have professionals as well as parents. That's a joint meeting down here, and you're very, very welcome to join us.
Great. This is from Beth in Irving, Texas, and there are a few people who've asked similar questions, so that's why I'm throwing this one out at you. How does floor time differ from RDI, and how does it differ from the sunrise approach?
Really good questions. Again, you know, I have a whole PowerPoint on how it differs from RDI that's on circle stretch, and I'll start by saying that if you look at, you know, kind of the RDI manuals, one of the premises is the kind of mentor and trainee relationship. I don't think I have those words right, but basically the idea, and it's a very poignant quote that Goodstein will make, is that it makes no sense. I'm not quoting it exactly, but basically he's saying that it makes no sense to have a child who doesn't know you know, anything about anything, be taking the lead. We really have to show them the way. You know, that's sort of, you know, the bottom line. And the antithesis to that is Dr. Serena Weider, you know, with Greenspan. Serena is saying, you know, when we don't tell someone what to do and when we don't get in the way of their thinking, then they have the room to kind of grow with their ideas. We can support their development. And again, I butchered it a little bit, but it's on the PowerPoint, which I could pull up, but I don't want to spend time doing that. You can see it on Circle Stretch. So, you know, the bottom line is that RDI is a mentor-mentee relationship where you're teaching social cognitive concepts in a manner that's graded in the sense that they look at various developmental levels, which aren't unlike the DIR ones. They kind of came after DIR, so some people would argue that Goodstein borrowed from DIR. I'm not sure that's true, but some people say that. But prescribes, it looks at where a child is functioning and then prescribes specific kinds of games, and they've got a million interesting games, to try to help the child move to the next level. And so you're supposed to do those games in a fairly specific way. If you take DIR, DIR would look at similar developmental levels, if not almost the same developmental levels, and they would say in every interaction on any particular day, you don't really know where a child's going to be. They're going to come in, they're going to be different every time. So you're always paying attention to the bottom of the rung first. You're always paying attention to co-regulation and then engagement and then circles of interaction and then trying to get a flow going and then trying to take that up. In fact, that happens with me every day. If I, you know, don't have my morning cup of tea, you know, I'm not regulated and I'm not going to function at my best. So everybody's got to sort of come into their ability in any particular moment to engage. And in fact, you'll often find that the people will have, you know, a bad day, and so they won't be doing what you want them to do. So if you're doing an RDI approach, for instance, and the child is generally able to do something at one level, but now they can't do it because, well, they're having a bad day, well, then what are you supposed to do? You have to sort of back up. Well, DIR has sort of a dynamic approach, which is, you know, again, from the bottom up in terms of, you know, the most fundamental things and then working to be as complex as you can make it on that particular day. And growing the interaction together so that you don't know exactly what you're going to be doing that tries to help someone meet a higher developmental level. You just know that you're going for that higher developmental level and you're going to co-create it somehow. So there's a real trust in the process of, you know, we're going to go on this journey and we're going to find something better, something more interesting, but I'm not telling you what we're going to find because I don't know what we're going to find because, you know, we're just not sure. With RDI, it's this is what you do now, this is what you do next. And, you know, certainly my experience with that is that they can be complementary, that people can certainly learn from RDI certain skills. Yet if you want people to generalize and think more for themselves in an sort of integrated, less conscious way, I think DIR is very, very helpful. And another contrast would be that RDI really, I think, is more for the higher functioning, more verbal people more often. And it asks people to think about their thinking at all times. So thinking about, you know, what am I doing in this interaction? How am I relating to this other person? Am I doing it right? And I think that's a very difficult thing to do. I think if you successfully bring into yourself all the things that RDI would like to teach you, and it becomes very natural, it's kind of like playing piano. You practice the scales, and then it becomes natural, integral, and you don't have to think about it anymore. That would be great. But I think it's very hard to do and to learn that way. DIR doesn't really spend the same kind of time being as explicit in the interactions themselves, but when you're planning and anticipating later on, you're certainly talking about, you know, how an interaction went, and you might be using very similar ideas to what RDI would in terms of social coaching and social cognitive approaches, like maybe what Michelle Garcia Winner would be teaching someone about how do you think about a situation and plan for it for the next time. Very useful stuff, and certainly part of DIR floor time. But what's kind of different about DIR is that, again, in your interactions with people, they're much more organic, much more implicit than explicit. Now, Sunrise, I'm not an expert on Sunrise. I've read a couple books about it. But my understanding about Sunrise is that there's some real similarities with DIR in the sense that you're looking at what the child's doing and you're trying to join them in that and really appreciate what they're doing. And then, you know, as, you know, you become part of a shared world, the child sort of naturally picks up on what you're doing and becomes more normalized. And so I think there's some real similarities there. I would say that one of the main differences, and again, I do not pretend to be an expert at it, is that I would say that DIR thinks about that, but in a framework of these developmental levels that go everywhere from, you know, co-regulation through to, you know, very high-functioning empathy, and then more broadly out, thinking about individual differences and family structure in a manner that's, again, I would say more like the biopsychosocial model. I would say that Sunrise, as I understand it, is certainly focused on families and has, you know, lots of family days where they bring people in and try to help them understand their model, but is focused a lot more on the interaction and on the mirroring or the joining of the child without necessarily the other pieces that DIR wants to pay attention to in terms of trying to expand, for instance, sensory processing ability or looking at, you know, would a parent be benefiting from, you know, something else in their lives so that their life is better? So there's a broadness to DIR that's I think, less the emphasis than Sunrise.
Great. Martha in Hampton, Virginia, wants to know what tips you have for using a communication device when doing floor time.
I'm sorry, say again, tips for communication?
For using a communication device?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. A couple summers ago, I think it was 2007, at our Summer Institute up in Asilomar, California, a lot of people were talking very excitedly about the Tango, which is one of the assisted communication devices, and speaking about it, and I don't think everybody uses it, is able to use it as well, you know, as others. You know, it's always hard to try to figure out a match between a kid and a device. But I would say that you want to try to use a device in a way that is beyond just asking for things, beyond just manding, and try to figure out how you can use it as a way to talk about what's going on or comment about what's going on. As opposed to putting together, I want juice, I want this, I am going to do this next, you know, scheduling kinds of things, or, you know, this is a cat, or, oh, I see the dog, or I want a kitty. Instead of that stuff, the kinds of things that I'd be interested in seeing on any communication device would be, I like this, or I love that, or I don't like this. You know, things that are commenting about things that are about the process, or about, you know, how people respond to something. This makes me mad. If you can try to figure out how to use it in a way that creates more of a conversation, then I think you're in better shape. And in fact, I'm not sure if they're available on the web, but there are some really nice videos, and maybe they're in the Floor Time Repository. Floor Time Repository is another resource. It's not an ICDL sanctioned resource. It's really kind of almost like an open source resource. Parents who are putting up videos and things, but so there might be some Tango things there, or maybe in some of the Tango material. And I'm not here to push Tango. but that's the device that I've seen used in a much more fluid way, where instead of doing rote kinds of things like what you might do in a behavioral program, you see a child kind of talking at the dinner table with a verbal sister and verbal parents about what their day was like and kind of commenting on it. And it has a much more natural and organic feel to it. And you can see that the child is much more invested in using it because the interaction is more meaningful. And that brings us to, you know, we always say, you know, when you say autism, what do you mean by that? You know, the spectrum is so wide, the causes of things that look like autism are so broad, and we have plenty of people who it seems like when you give them voice through one method or another, there's a lot more in there than you thought was in there. So, you know, the question here is, when you give them a voice with a tango, can you create something that is, you know, much more organic and meaningful and interesting to the child? Because, well, you know, they have that capacity if you give them the help. And I would like to offer a very poor man's assisted technology device. And it's a very imperfect one, but it's a really interesting one, and that's you. Lots of times, you can be the assisted technology device, not because the kid is pushing an icon, but because you know your child, and you know what the child wants, and you can interpret, and you can kind of say, oh, you know, you don't like that. Or even better, you can interpret for the child who might not quite be getting the nonverbal cues of somebody else around them, what's going on, like, oh, Johnny wants your bunny. I don't know what we're going to do about that. So you're just kind of talking about the situation, interpreting the situation. You're being the assisted technology for the entire situation. Think about that. I mean, take some time to think about. But when you think about yourself as the interpreter for the situation, when it's needed, you don't want to overcall it, but it's often extremely helpful in kind of slowing down a little bit and interpreting a situation so that there can be a more meaningful and successful and fun communication with other people. And plenty of times, the way that you do that, the way that, you know, they, for instance, push your icon, so to speak, is you're reading their gestural, their nonverbal cues, and you're responding with your own nonverbal cues as well, and they're learning to read that better. So even beyond the utility of an assisted technology device or, oh, my God, the robot that they're talking about on, you know, in some of these articles and on the Internet, don't get me started there, you're talking about using people to help interpret the world. And I would offer that it's a rougher device, but it's, in the end, maybe a better device to use is you.
Good. Gosh, so much information that you're giving us, Dr. Fader.
I'm sorry.
No,
I can talk
great.
All night. That's the problem.
That's great. It's really wonderful. A few people have emailed in and asked for your email address because you mentioned at some point that somebody could email you. Is there any way you have an email address to give to people?
Yeah, I will give you my email. You'll get a bounce back if you email me that says, this is not for urgent matters, and I would remind you that I can't treat people from a distance, and I do get a couple hundred emails a day. So if I don't respond to you, you know, immediately, I only apologize that I can't respond to everyone immediately, but I usually can respond eventually. So as long as you can live with eventually, my email address is jdfeder@pol.net, and because nobody can understand those things when I say them, I'll do it in American military lingo, which is usually easier to understand. So it goes like Juliet, Delta, Foxtrot, Echo, Delta, Echo, Romeo, @papaoscarlima.net, jdfader@pol.net. But again, you know, you'll get a bounce back that says, this is not for urgent matters. I can't do medical stuff, you know, from a distance. It's actually unethical and illegal. But I can certainly, you know, try to point you somewhere helpful and talk about invitations to India. And it may take a while to respond. But, you know, whatever. It's what I do. It's okay.
So here's one from B10 from Flower Mound. Autistic children often have lots of anxieties. How can we use floor time to reduce or eliminate the children's anxieties?
Well, that's a great question. Reducing anxiety that's overwhelming, that's a really good goal. Eliminating anxiety is problematic in that if you don't have any anxiety, then, well, you know, you're not really motivated to do anything. Some people would argue that a little bit of, you know, that gives you a little bit of motivation to do things. Because I'm a little hungry, you know, I'm going to work today so I can make a little money so I can buy some food. You know, so a little bit of anxiety is probably okay, but it's a lot of anxiety that's so problematic for so many people, not just with autism, but, you know, with all kinds of, well, just people. That kind of goes back to a number of things. Part of it is the basics, you know, co-regulation, engagement, and reciprocal interaction. So what I mean by that is if you have somebody who's anxious, you want to try to figure out, okay, what are they anxious about? If there's something specific, is there a way that you can kind of join with them, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, in, you know, kind of empathizing with whatever it is they're anxious about, or even in just being anxious, back to that kind of 80% idea where you're almost as, you're very concerned and you're showing that, but you're not as concerned as they are because that's not helpful. And helping them feel a little bit understood, even if we don't know the source of the anxiety. And that alone, thinking about what we can do about it, and that might be something that's co-regulated. It might be something that you can woo them into an interaction that's, you know, physical, for instance, for some people, for a lot of people, when they're just sitting there and kind of anxious, we're kind of talking with them, working with them a little bit, and wooing them, if we can, into, you know, some walking or jogging or running or swimming or things that will help them get become more regulated, you know, especially rhythmic aerobic exercise can often be, you know, incredibly helpful. And just the fact that you're kind of spending time trying to engage with someone often helps them kind of regulate a little bit better. Now, there's another side to that. There's kind of the dark side where someone is anxious and they're wanting you to be there for them, and so you're kind of, you know, soothing them, and then all they need is, what they seem to need is more and more soothing, and it's like a bottomless pit, and they're sucking you dry, you know, sucking you in, and that's problematic. So you need to be mindful that you're not merely just soothing someone, and you're kind of encouraging them by stepping down your level of intensity in small increments and getting more active, for instance, and or talking about, you know, trying to understand what's bothering them so that, you know, you can sort of problem solve together. And by problem solve, I don't mean just giving them advice. That usually doesn't work for a verbal, particularly autistic kid. Usually it's coming up with something together, whether it's a play activity or an activity that's, you know, kind of physical, or sometimes, you know, talking about a strategy that you might try, that you're coming up with together that might work, or even kind of fantasizing about things that might be interesting to try, and you'll never try, but they're kind of fun to think about. They kind of relieve the anxiety and take you from being stuck in the moment to, you know, with luck, symbolic thinking, which is thinking about the situation rather than just being anxious about the situation. So, you know, it's a very, you know, you're talking about a very broad and complex area, but again, you know, kind of back to basic principles, you're starting with co-regulation, you're trying to engage with someone, you're trying to be understanding and empathic with them, and you're trying to lead them with you, woo them with you towards kind of a relationship that's a problem-solving, there you go, social problem-solving relationship, as opposed to just soothing them or just medicating them or just extinguishing it by ignoring them. Great example of that is anxious kid won't go to sleep at night. Do you, A, close the door and let the baby teach himself how to get to bed, B, sleep with the baby forever, or C, do something in between? Well, this is like the in-between, and it's, you know, you make mistakes, you fall down, you try different things, you reflect on it, you see what works, but you try to find that in-between so that you're not going totally where the person is, but you're also not ignoring them totally, which in a way doesn't teach them anything about empathy or about theory of mind. All it teaches them is to either be more anxious or to not trust you.
Very interesting. Here's one from Holly in North Carolina. She says or asks, in regards to children with behavioral issues, I would like to ask if the child gets very upset, i.e. hitting, biting, punching, of another child during an engagement, for example, in gym class or recess at school, how would you solve that problem? How would you get them from that point to a point that they can engage with other children?
Well, obviously, in the moment, you change the environment. You know, you remove other people away, and you make things safe. And you know, by the same token, unless everybody, including the adults, especially the adults, are feeling safe, you can't really make a whole lot of progress. It's very, very difficult. You're basically in sort of defensive combat mode. You can't think flexibly. So it may be that you find out what interactions are successful, and maybe they're not at PE yet. Maybe they're not on the playground. Those are some of the toughest places to be. Maybe they're more circumscribed, even semi-structured kinds of things that, you know, the kid likes and some other kid likes, and, you know, they're enjoyable. But first, I think you have to really work on helping the child be engaged and interactive with adults, and make sure that that's sort of a safe and regulated kind of thing. And then slowly, you know, think about older peers, in particular with a kid who's, you know, kind of aggressive. You don't want to start with younger peers or necessarily same age peers who are, as I said, the toughest peers to try to relate to. And find activities that are regulating and engaging and maybe semi-structured, and the child likes them, and you can fold somebody in gradually and kind of work from there in a very, very gradual way. The toughest thing you can probably do is put a kid like on a baseball team, you know, where, you know, there's so much going on, there's downtime in weird places, there's rules to know, there's kind of all kinds of physical actions to know about. I mean, there's so much there that it's practically impossible. And by extension, you know, a lot of times gym class is, you know, almost equally as difficult. So start with adults, try to make sure that you're working on those relationships, slowly maybe fold in older kids, make sure that everybody is feeling safe and that you've got a plan. Back to the, you know, how do you manage aggression? There's that slide on the PowerPoint we just looked at, but there's also a more expanded version of that in the DIR and the school's PowerPoint that's on Circle Stretch that talks, you know, really from Greenspan's framework of, you know, how do you manage this? You know, you're changing the environment to make it safe. You're soothing the child. You're talking about it. You're planning for next time. You know, it's all incorporated in there. And frankly, once you have a plan, then you're going to feel more comfortable and you're able to move forward. But obviously, it's absolutely unacceptable to have kids wailing on each other, beating each other. That's not going to work. And so you've got to be able to kind of start from scratch and work from there.
Now, Denise in Victoria wants to know, how do you track floor time progress? Like, what kind of data are you taking?
I really like using the FEDL. And if you saw, again, in that PowerPoint, those quick examples of where people are. You saw one child in, you know, different years. It was really year to year, where this child, where I was tracking that child. And obviously, you probably want to track a little bit more often than that, but this is a long-term situation, so I was using it as an example. But you want to look, and I use these FEDL sheets all the time. There's a more formal one that you can download from ICDL. It's probably in the guidelines that they have. It's like an 800-page PDF download that you can get for free. It's like in 8 different downloads, but it's huge. But there's that same form, but in an expanded version, and also the individual differences forms. And you can do those on a serial basis to show, you know, where you're at. There's another sheet we use locally in San Diego that my colleague Marilee Bergeson came up with that talks about, individual sessions. You know, what was the child doing? How did you join the child? What circles of interaction were possible? What did you do to set the environment to make it work? What did you do to expand things, you know, in the play? How did you expand things emotionally? What were the individual things about that child? And what different levels were you working on at the same time? And it kind of organizes your thinking, so session by session, you can look at that. And again, if you look at the PowerPoints on Circle Stretch, you're going to see the Marilee sheet repeated a number of times, and, you know, you can probably use that. I don't think she's copyrighted it, but I would ask that you give her credit, Marilee Bergeson, if you were going to use it. I don't know, Marilee's probably going to call me after this and say, hey! But in any case, we use that locally here. And we use the FEDL sheets. And then when I'm looking at tracking kids at school, we also have, and there's some forms, again, they're incorporated in the school's kind of PowerPoints. There's one, a PowerPoint that I did for Solana Beach School District locally here that includes a tracking form for looking at co-regulation, engagement, and reciprocity, and what does that look like, and how do you track it by taking 15-minute samples so you can see, during what percentage of that time was the child, you know, calm enough, but not too calm? During what percentage of the time did they seem, you know, really engaged with the process? And then how many circles of interaction did you see? And write some commentary about what you saw. And again, you don't just take data. You take data and then you reflect on it with somebody so that you can get an idea of, you know, how you're doing and what you might try. We also have boilerplate goals. For IEPs that are on circle stretch as well that you can kind of look at that also speak to co-regulation, engagement, and reciprocity circles of interaction. And also Monica Osgood at Celebrate the Children, the school in, I think it's Wharton, New Jersey. You can Google that school. She's going to be coming out with a whole goal bank that should be available this summer, probably going to be about 10, 20 bucks or something you can get. And so you can look at for various kinds of DIR levels, you know, functional, emotional, developmental levels, what kinds of goals might make sense. And they're more examples. I mean, every child is going to be different, but it's extremely helpful because, you know, they've been writing IEPs for years. I certainly help write a lot of IEPs. They've got a much more expanded version than my boilerplates, but they're out there. I think we have time for a few more questions, yeah?
You know what, it's 7:56, and I really have to cut it off at 8 o'clock, so we might have time for one more if we make it a quick answer.
Okay.
This is the last question for this evening. Don Party from New London, Connecticut. We recognize today that my PDD NOS 3-year-old son was able to focus on an activity without becoming overwhelmed because he has a pacifier and used it to keep his emotions in check. I want to wean him from a pacifier and want to know if there are other suggestions or items or tools that we can use to aid in focus or if the use of such a crutch is even advisable. He's 3 years old.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and we'll probably burn up the rest of our time on it. The short answer is I'd be much more worried about engagement and reciprocity than about the pacifier. The pacifier will probably drop once the other functions are in place. So unless there's a clear medical reason why he can't have it, I wouldn't have it. A lot of people don't want a kid to have a pacifier because they feel like it's getting in the way of his talking. But if you get too worried about the talking, then you're probably not worrying enough and working enough with the nonverbal. If you're working enough with the nonverbal communication and reciprocity, you're going to move towards a communication where they'll probably just let go of the pacifier. That said, there are some people who would take something like that away, just be done with it, and maybe give the kid an occasional something to chew. But usually, if they don't have the pacifier, they find their shirt and they end up chewing on that, and then basically you have a bunch of shirts with holes in them. So, you know, I find it a little bit I would generally try to get floor time really, really going and see where it leads you and see what progress you're making. And see then what happens with the pacifier, see if it's sort of left to the side. The other thing is a lot of sensory integration occupational therapists or speech therapists will be doing other kinds of oral motor work, giving chewy foods to chew on for part of the time to get that need met but then done with so he chews some whatever it is, swallows it, and then the need is gone for a while. So there's a bunch of ways to skin that cat. But, again, I'd be most interested in the engagement and reciprocity first.
Good answer, Dr. Fader. I want to thank you so much for your time this evening. Really wonderful information for everyone. This has been MomFightingAutism.com with Dr. Joshua Fader and Chantal Cecile Kira. Thank you.
Thank you.